In any war, there's always a risk. Soldiers will be captured. With Russia's war in Ukraine, a lot depends on what side captures you.
Those who've been held by the Russian side often seem to emerge looking emaciated, looking like they've not received proper medical treatment.
Also today on the show, a stinky brown seaweed is invading Caribbean waters.
You can see even today, there are some out there, some brown you can see there.
When it reaches the beach, it's really bad for business. I'm Marco Werman, plus hip-hop turns 50 this summer. We hear how a sound from the Bronx captivated the globe, from Kathmandu to Cairo.
And there on an ancient wall that is crumbling to the ground is graffiti commemorating the lives of Tupac and Biggie.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being here today. A new phase of the war in Ukraine has begun. Reports say that Ukrainian forces are attacking Russian lines of defense in the southeastern part of the country. This suggests that Ukraine's long-anticipated counteroffensive appears to be underway. Assuming things proceed as the Ukrainian government is hoping, it would be the beginning of a campaign to retake parts of Ukraine held by Russia for a year or more. Another possible outcome is that Ukraine will be capturing more Russian troops as prisoners of war. The World's Daniel Hoffman recently visited a detention facility in Kharkiv, Ukraine, where he spoke with some Russian POWs.
In Ukraine, there are dozens of sites where captured Russian troops are held. One of them is here in the city of Kharkiv. This is Kharkiv Pretrial Detention Center number 27. It's got a long history going back more than 170 years. The walls outside are faded yellow, topped with barbed wire. At maximum capacity, the place holds about 1,500 inmates.
Nice to meet you. Hello. My name is Daniel.
Back before Russia's invasion, this was a regular jail. Now there's a different population of inmates here.
Военнопленные начали поступать практически, я боюсь ошибиться, но это в самые первые дни.
Deputy Warden Dmitry Holod says Ukraine's military started sending Russian POWs here about a year ago.
Военнопленные у нас цифра постоянно меняется, то есть.
They keep the Russian POWs separate from the rest of the inmates. This place holds about 90 Russian POWs at a time. They spend a few weeks here typically, and then they're transferred to a facility in western Ukraine, designated for POWs.
So we just spoke with the deputy warden, and now we're being taken to an adjacent building where some POWs are held, and that's where we're going to speak with a couple of them.
In cell number 18, I meet several Russian prisoners. The Ukrainian guards leave the room. Under these circumstances, though, it's hard to say whether these men are speaking completely freely. We're not revealing the prisoners' names and other details out of concern for their safety. A prisoner in a camouflage jacket in his late 20s says back in Russia he worked at a supermarket. He says he was drafted earlier this year, got 2 weeks of training, and was sent to the front lines in Ukraine's Donetsk region. We were put in the trenches, on the second line of defense, he tells me. And we were told to defend our position. But a couple of weeks later, this prisoner says he came to a conclusion. He says he didn't want to fight anymore. So one night he hopped out of the Russian trench and walked towards the Ukrainian side. He was taken prisoner and then sent here. He says he's been interrogated here by Ukrainian security officials and that overall he's been treated well. He says he gets 3 meals a day, clean clothing, and even books to read. The other prisoners I speak with tell me something similar. One guy says he was captured in an ambush, injured, and received medical care after being taken prisoner. All the men I meet here say they're hoping to be included in a prisoner exchange so that they could go back home. As for what I saw and heard at the Kharkiv detention center, there are long-established laws for the treatment of prisoners of war.
The Geneva Conventions are the basis for the conduct of parties during a conflict.
Wayne Jordash is an international criminal lawyer based in Kyiv.
The basis of the law is that prisoners of war should be treated humanely. That's the underlying premise of all treatment of prisoners of war. So the Geneva Conventions, in a sense, codified all of that to establish this standard framework.
From what he knows about the treatment of POWs during the war in Ukraine, Jordash says there's a big disparity.
I think you can see the difference between prisoners of war that have been held by the Ukrainian side and those that have been held by the Russian side. Those who've been held by the Russian side often seem to emerge looking emaciated, looking like they have not received proper medical treatment, telling stories of torture and ill treatment.
Jordash says that this kind of treatment likely amounts to Russian war crimes. This is Spartak Borisenko. He's the head of the Special Department for War Crime Investigations at the Kharkiv Prosecutor's Office. He describes the process of what happens with Russian POWs once they're taken into Ukrainian custody.
They're being taken by the military. Once they've been captured by the military, they pass them on to military police. The military police then registers them and then brings them to this pretrial detention center.
At places like the one I visited in Kharkiv, Russian POWs are questioned about potential war crimes, and their statements are recorded as evidence.
We do hope that the cases we're working on, that the evidence that we're collecting, will be then used by the investigators of the International Criminal Court in The Hague or any other venue for investigation of these crimes.
But the vast majority of these individual cases will never go to the International Criminal Court. Most make their way through Ukraine's court system. Borisenko says Ukraine is investigating about 85,000 cases of potential Russian war crimes. In Kharkiv, a few dozen Russian troops have been found guilty. But Ukrainian law allows for the transfer of Russian POWs even after they've been convicted. Petro Yatsenko is with Ukraine's coordination headquarters for treatment of POWs.
We are arranging exchanges every 2 weeks or even twice in a week. Because of that, in case we have a lot of exchanges, the number of current prisoners of war is decreasing.
Yatsenko says these negotiations are ongoing. Ukrainian military intelligence officials are in communication with their Russian counterparts.
We have special negotiation groups from our side and from Russian side. Sometimes the negotiation process takes months. It's a very long period of time.
Russia and Ukraine have been swapping prisoners throughout the war. Yatsenko won't disclose how many Russian prisoners of war are in Ukrainian custody, but he does say this.
Our fund of Russian prisoners of war is less than Russians because during the first period of war, Russia captured a lot of Ukrainian soldiers.
Yatsenko hopes that the counteroffensive will result in the capture of many more Russian soldiers who can then be exchanged for Ukrainian POWs.
We propose in Russia to exchange all Ukrainians to all Russians. But Russia isn't interested.
On Tuesday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said that more than 2,500 Ukrainians have been freed as a result of prisoner swaps with Russia. He said the international community needs to keep pressuring Russia and help Ukraine bring all of its citizens back home. For the World, Daniel Hoffman, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
Just over a year ago, Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was shot dead in the West Bank town of Jenin. It's widely acknowledged that the fatal shot came from the Israeli Defense Forces, but the exact circumstances remain a mystery. The U.S. State Department put together a classified report of its findings. Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, has been able to read it and joins us. Senator, you've repeatedly called for an independent U.S. investigation. When you finished reading this report, had you gotten the answers you were looking for?
Well, I think this report certainly contains a substantial amount of information that shed light
on the circumstances of the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. As to the question of intention of the IDF soldier, I know independently that the USSC, this is the U.S. Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian authorities, was not given access to key witnesses. So he was unable to do an independent investigation in that sense. Nevertheless, he's compiled lots of important information that shed light on the circumstances of Shireen Abu Akleh's killing. And I think it's very important that those findings be released.
So the research group, Forensic Architecture, whom we interviewed on the show, they did a 3D reconstruction of the shooting using a lot of cell phone footage, and they were able to trace the trajectory of the shots that killed Shireen Abu Akleh to an armored IDF vehicle and the port in its side where a sniper shot from. Now, you say soldiers, so there is an individual in question who may have been the shooter. I mean, was the U.S. security coordinator able to interview whomever pulled the trigger?
And again, I can't go into the details of the report right now, but I can say from independent information provided by the State Department that the answer is no, that the U.S. Security Coordinator was not able to interview any of the key witnesses, which is why this report cannot shed new light on the question of intentionality. But this report, nevertheless, can provide very important and does provide important information about the conduct of that IDF unit.
Will the State Department or even the Department of Justice push for more access? And do you think a push could amount to anything, or will the IDF continue to rebuff?
Well, I think that the State Department needs to continue to push. You know, the Secretary of State has made statements, and in order for us to maintain our credibility, it seems to me he needs to continue to push.
Since Benjamin Netanyahu's new right-wing government took over, have you noticed any differences in how the Israeli government is handling this case?
In terms of this particular case?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any change.
I think it's fair to describe the approach the Biden White House has taken regarding the new Netanyahu administration as cautious. How much do you think the pace of the U.S. investigation into Shireen Abu Akleh's killing is a function of how Washington seems a little uncertain of how to deal with an old ally that it has now some issues with?
Well, I think that the Biden administration needs to press on a number of fronts, including this one, where we're talking about the killing of an American citizen. It's important to determine whether U.S. military assistance in this case or others is being used consistent with American law. And so it's important that the Biden administration undertake these kind of reviews and also continue to press for changes in the rules of engagement.
Would you argue to the Biden administration that U.S. military assistance to Israel needs to be reexamined in the light of her killing?
I'm not talking about broad U.S. military assistance to Israel in this case. I'm talking about the use by particular units of U.S. assistance. And we have already, as part of our law, the so-called Leahy laws, named after former Senator Patrick Leahy, that require the vetting of military units around the world that are prospective recipients of U.S. military assistance. And so I believe that the Biden administration needs to undertake that review in this case and other cases where evidence indicates the likelihood of gross violations of human rights.
Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Aside from evacuating thousands of people and their homes getting destroyed, there's another dire complication from that dam breach in southern Ukraine, landmines. When the Kakhovka Dam burst in Ukraine's Kherson region, it not only washed away property, the waters also dislodged an unknowable amount of unexploded ordnance. Timur Pistryuha is the head of the Ukrainian D-Miners Association based in Kyiv, but their D-Miners work all over Ukraine. I asked him where these mines were before the flooding began in this region.
In the Russia-occupied side, because they created defense position, and they try to protect their position by means of mines. So many mines, anti-transfer mine, anti-personal mine, probably improvised explosive devices and unexploded ordnance, because all this territory, our territory, was under the shelling, because it's like front line and it's all go under water.
How are the mines generally moored to the ground, and how were they uprooted, if we can call it that?
It depends on mine, because, for example, TM-62 is quite heavy, but other mine, like anti-personnel mine or cluster munition, actually, which is also quite dangerous, even for the miners, not only for civilians. But we also should note another thing, that all this ammunition, traditional mine like TM-62, when the miner come, he or she understand how it's the mine, because it's like classical method, yes. But now, because it's affected by war and probably some other external impact, like some soil or other external impact on this, we cannot predict in which condition it will be when we are started to mine this.
Yeah, it sounds like the water could cause problems for the mines. It could rust them. It could short circuit things and make things very unpredictable.
Yeah.
You mentioned the unexploded ordnance, Timur, that's also now underwater. I mean, talk more about the dangers of that.
Yes, it's still dangerous, especially like clustered munitions. It's dangerous, and many incidents which happened with civilian population here in Ukraine, not only due to mines, but also due to unexploded ordnance.
So the floods are still happening. When will the D-miners even be able to reach the mines now with the floods?
It's a difficult question, because now all my country care about protection people, deliver some humanitarian aid like water bottles and et cetera, et cetera. So when started some demining procedure, first of all, level of water should decrease.
I mean, you make a point there about the humanitarian mission, getting food, clean water, new shelter to people. But I'm wondering whether this mine problem is going to hamper rescue efforts now.
Yes, that's why the first day my organization Ukraine recommendation and how people, especially humanitarian actors, should do if they are facing this threat, like mines on an exploded ordnance. It's unpredictable, actually, but we should be prepared, and civilian, first of all, population should be prepared.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, Timur, what your concerns are for the long term now that these landmines are strewn randomly across the countryside. I mean, it makes life really unpredictable.
It's very difficult to predict everything when war still ongoing. But I believe all together with our partners, with USA and other people who support us, we all together solve this problem as quick as possible. But unfortunately, Russia make it more and more complicated for us.
That was Timur Pistriyuha. He's the head of the Ukrainian D-Miners Association based in Kyiv. If you're planning a trip to Florida or the Caribbean this summer, you'd better check the sargassum forecast. This prolific brown seaweed has been growing in excessive amounts in the area for a dozen years now. Earlier this year, scientists detected a record bloom. Gisele Regatao reports from Half Moon Bay on the island of Antigua and how it's coping with the piles of seaweed washed up on the sand and its unavoidable stench.
Half Moon Bay is probably the most famous beach on Antigua, but on this gorgeous day, it's completely empty. The only person on the sand is a man on a tractor. He's removing sargassum that is covering the whole beach.
Got to do what we got to do.
Avery Henry is the owner of Beach Bum Bar and Grill, a restaurant right at the beach.
We've been quiet for ages, but now they're starting to feel what we are feeling.
And yeah. How is it affecting our business? Because we're right here.
You can see.
The restaurant is totally empty. He says tourists get here and turn around. It's a huge contrast from a few years ago.
At one point, Half Moon Bay was ranked top 5 in the world, so it's world renowned. Yeah.
In the ocean, sargassum is an important nutrient for fish. The problem is when it gets to the beach. As it decomposes, it attracts bacteria and produces a gas that smells like rotten eggs. Chuan Ming Wu is a professor of oceanography at the University of South Florida. He says nobody's certain about what brought sargassum to the Caribbean 12 years ago.
As of today, it's still a mystery, but there are some hypotheses, some of which are more plausible than others.
He says one viable hypothesis is that in 2010, there was an ocean current much stronger than usual. It came from the northern Atlantic and pushed the sargassum to the tropical Atlantic, where it found perfect conditions to grow.
Light, nutrients, temperature. So in the tropic Atlantic, everything is just right. So then we started to see more and more sargassum this year.
After a spike in March, he says sargassum dropped a bit in May, but it's still going to be all over the Caribbean, Mexico, and parts of Florida.
I was a little scared because I know the worst is yet to come in the summer.
He says local authorities can try to get boats to collect it in the ocean, but that's expensive.
It's hundreds of miles. So there's no way to stop this phenomenon in nature. This is just like nobody can really stop a hurricane.
A few miles from Half Moon Bay, another beach in Antigua is sargassum-free today. Fabio Giorgi is the general manager of the Inn at English Harbor. He says at this beach, Freeman's Bay, the sargassum only comes about three times a year.
Normally the wind is always, you can see even today, there are some out there, some brown you can see there, but they don't come in, they just keep going up. So we are lucky.
When the sargassum does come in, he says they can call the environmental department to do the cleaning, or often they take care of it themselves. The process takes about 3 days.
You clean, but there are still some in the sea when that happens. So then you need to wait the next day for them to come up.
While sargassum keeps coming, local communities are also finding new uses for it. Professor Wu says it can be used as a fertilizer and other things.
People make bricks, construction material from sargassum, and they make sargassum shoes or even clothes.
He says there might be some pharmaceutical use as well, but research is in development. For a lot of the Caribbean, there's still no remedy for it. For the world, I'm Gisele Regatao, Freetown and English Harbor, Antigua.
You're listening to The World. It may be the biggest question of all, how did life on Earth begin? Some clues might be buried at the planet's core. You have to drill impossibly far down to get there. But recently, the improbable worked.
We kept going because we just couldn't believe our eyes that this was actually happening.
More than a century after Jules Verne, a real journey to the center of the Earth. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 50 years ago this summer, a Jamaican DJ named Kool Herc wanted to throw a party in his new neighborhood, the Bronx. His concept, a celebration with music that would echo the dancehall scene he remembered back home in Kingston. Music historians point to that August night in 1973 as the birth of hip-hop. This summer, we're going to explore how and where hip-hop has traveled since that party a half century ago in the Bronx. To launch this multi-part journey, we're turning to H. Sammy Alim. He's a professor of anthropology and director of the Hip-Hop Initiative at UCLA.
My own introduction to hip-hop was very early on. I was born in 77, and then about 10 years after that, I was probably 8, 9, 10 when I started hearing all of the music of that time period blasting out of my older brother's room. Some think that we can't flow. Can't flow. Stereotypes, they got to go. Got to go. I'ma mess around and flip the scene into
reverse. With what? With a little touch of latest first. Sammy is now steeped in the study of hip-hop. More than that, he sees how hip-hop has become a teaching tool for communities around the globe. When Sammy first heard the sound, it struck him as multi-layered, and he saw its potential.
I was listening to something that was musical, that was poetic, that was political, that was strong, and it was funky, and it had a rhyme, and you could dance dance to it. So it was all of those things that kids love. That's what you're looking for, but you were also being educated at the same time, because remember, so much of the hip hop at that time period was about gaining knowledge of self. That was so critical. So many of the artists, right? We have Stetsasonic, Public Enemy, Queen Latifah, you name it. Everybody was sort of kicking that knowledge of self and trying to pass it on through the music.
Talk more about that idea that hip hop provided this knowledge of self.
That's right. So for me, there's a very important story when I was growing up. I remember a song by Stetsasonic, and it was called Africa. A-F-R-I-C-A. Angola, Soweto, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Zambia, Mozambique, and Botswana. So let us speak about the motherland. And that was so critical as a 10-year-old listening to that, because you have to remember, in public education and public schools, we didn't learn anything about Africa. This is the miseducation that most folks were going through in the United States and continue to go through. You don't learn anything about it. So to have to learn about Africa through hip hop music was revolutionary to me. I learned more as a 10-year-old in that, through that one song, let alone the rest of the music, than I did in my entire schooling as a child. I know this girl whose name is Lola. She lives in a country called Angola. Her president's name is Dos Santos, and a man named Stephen be playing him too close. She says, hey brother, my country's in a war. We are fighting rebels back by Pretoria. Africa by Stetsasonic was, it sounds like, vindication for your search for more information in history. Absolutely. It was a vindication that I felt at that age I never even knew I needed to have.
So, Sammy, you've selected three other tracks that have relevance in our discussion. Let's pair Africa by Stetsasonic with this one from Cape Town, South Africa. It was released in 1995.
Never and never again shall it be that this beautiful love will again experience the oppression of one by another.
That, of course, is the unmistakable voice of Nelson Mandela sampled there. Sammy, who is this and what's this track about?
So Never Again is a song by Prophets of the City. And this song is so important to me. This is transitioning now from high school to college. And this is the Prophets of the City celebrating the end of the apartheid regime, right? The return of Nelson Mandela. And you have their album, Age of Truth, being banned by the apartheid regime just 1 year earlier. So for them to play at the inauguration of Nelson Mandela is huge, huge, huge historically and politically. And so I think hip hop, again, continues to be so critical to resistance movements and to revolutionary movements all around the world. And this song by one of South Africa's pioneers really demonstrates that. So I dedicate this to those who don't turn the other cheek, and to those who would rather speak against colonialism, imperialism, and racism. So I'm bringing it back to the basics, and I know that those who support that struggle locally, I support your struggle. Really shows how hip-hop has become this global form of activist expression. Sammy, you're not by any means alone in this adventure, if we can call it that. Hip-hop is global, arguably the most influential music genre in the world today. Can you just help us understand the appeal? Why is it so influential to kids in places as diverse as South Africa and South Korea? It's so interesting because I teach a course on hip-hop, race, and social justice from South Central to South Africa. Mm. And we travel around the world. And one of the things we realize together as a whole group of students is that everywhere around the world where you have youth fighting and resisting their marginalization and oppression, hip hop in some way, shape, or form becomes sort of that call for that resistance, that soundtrack for their liberation. So these youth are in love with the music and now turn to gaining a knowledge of themselves. And what does it mean that we are here oppressed? Why don't we pick up this art form, use it as our weapon to fight our oppression? And it is a powerful, powerful thing to see.
I'm wondering if you find that call and response a lot, the call and response, if you will, between the source of hip hop, the U.S. and the rest of the globe.
I love that you frame it as a call and response. And I do. There is so many ways hip hop culture in the United States has set trends for global hip hop culture. That's the call. The response by the globe initially was to sort of imitate and emulate what was going on in Black American music, which was hip hop music, Eventually, that response became, let's do this with our own twist.
This summer, the world is listening to the global impact of hip-hop as it marks 50 years from its inception in the South Bronx. And helping us kick off the series is Sami Alim, anthropologist and head of the hip-hop initiative at UCLA. So we just heard the role of hip-hop in ending apartheid in South Africa, Sami. The next track you selected takes us to the occupied territories in the Mideast.
This track by Dam, it's a Palestinian group. They're in occupied territories within Israeli borders. The song is called Min Erhabi, or Who is the Terrorist? So already from the title of the song, you get that this is within the hip-hop tradition of flipping the script. By asking the question, who is the terrorist, this Palestinian group is clearly pushing back against descriptions and narratives of Palestinians as terrorists. Okay, so they're sort of pushing back and saying, well, who is the terrorist? Who has the power here? Who is occupying whom? And they're raising that question through hip-hop music. This is what I mean by hip-hop going global and youth all around the world picking it up as a source of inspiration for their struggle and for their movements.
It is easy to see how Dam has an impact on Palestinians living under Israeli law and how they think of their situation. I am thinking, though, of perhaps a whole cohort of listeners for whom hip-hop is not their thing. They may feel that hip-hop has not had an impact on their life. I think of writer James McBride, who famously wrote in 2007 that he ignored it, only to later realize that hip-hop rules the world. So I'd love to know from you, Sami, how you see the impact of hip-hop on those who may feel it has not touched them in some way.
I have to tell you, it's hard in this day and age to find folks like that, honestly, because hip-hop has moved from hip-hop culture to popular culture. It's almost everywhere you look. You can't even walk into Whole Foods here in the United States or a Trader Joe's or your bank or your gym, anywhere really, without hearing hip-hop culture. In Palestine, in places like Syria and elsewhere, that's not going to be the case. But what hip-hop has done is sort of galvanized a certain political consciousness.
Sami, you mentioned Syria, so let's check out one more song you've selected, the tune #Jan25, a collective of African-American and Arab-American Muslim artists inspired by the Arab Spring, the anti-government protests that erupted throughout the Middle East in 2011.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Medina's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost.
One name I know here is Omar Effendim. Remind us who he is collaborating here with and what the song is about.
Omar Effendim is another incredibly talented creative artist. He has collaborated with artists around the world. He has continued to push not only the poetic envelope, but the political envelope. So #Jan25 refers to that date that the Egyptian people rose up against their government. And they want to use that hashtag, right, to create a certain sense of solidarity of all the people in that region who are rising up at that time period.
Freedom isn't given by oppressors, it's demanded by oppressed. Freedom lovers, freedom fighters, freedom gatherer, protest for the God-given rights, for the freedom of the press. We know freedom is the answer. The only question is, who's next?
#Jan25 from Omar Effendim and a host of other artists. Sami, it seems we've only touched the tip of the iceberg. We do live on planet hip-hop, but aside from the sound and lyrics, I'm just curious how you measure whether hip-hop has served as an agent of change for the grievances that emerge when artists express them.
As it spreads around the globe, and as a scholar of global hip-hop culture, everywhere I go, I'm seeing this. I could tell you, I went to Thailand, I was in Bangkok, and I'm in the streets walking on the day before my lecture, and there is an entire B-boy, B-girl dance competition happening on a stage, on the streets. Everywhere I go, you see those flavors of hip-hop culture. I could take you back the first time I was in Cairo. This was in the 90s, I would say mid-90s, and there on an ancient wall that is crumbling to the ground is graffiti commemorating the lives of Tupac and Biggie. In a place that you would least expect it, a remote sort of countryside outside of Cairo on a crumbling building.
That image literally just made my hair stand on end. You can't.
It was incredible. It was incredible, Marco. Imagine me as a kid. So I'm there and I'm seeing these walls, right? Then I'm walking in a street and I'm in Alexandria at this point, and walking are these young Egyptian kids. They must be, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, rapping, "Jesus, the notorious, just please us with your lyrical thesis." And I'm hearing them rapping the Notorious B.I.G. in English. And they are Arabic speakers who are learning English through hip hop. And it's just blowing my mind all over again, right? So it's an interesting thing, a phenomenal thing, and a very powerful thing to witness as a person who travels through these different areas.
H. Sami Alim is a professor of anthropology and director of the Hip Hop Initiative at UCLA. He's also the co-editor of the book Freedom Moves. Sami, thanks so much for getting us started, and we'll catch up with you again this summer as we continue to celebrate 50 years of hip hop. We really appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much, Marco. Please us with your lyrical thesis. We just chillin', milkin', Bob Dylan, silkin', pure linen, me and little C,
Malibu sea breeze, on peace, palm trees, cats made hot blow. Taiwan is having a Me Too moment. Late last week, government officials were accused of sexual harassment or of covering it up. New allegations are emerging each day. From Taipei, Ashish Valentine reports.
Taiwanese audiences turned on their TVs last week to see officials from the DPP bowing deeply to apologize for a sexual harassment allegation. Then the next day, new allegations and a new apology, along with promises to change the way the party handles sexual harassment. Then a third day of allegations and a third apology. Here's party chairman and presidential candidate Lai Ching-te. I once again express my deepest apology to all those who've been injured in the DPP because I did not stand with you when you needed it most, he said. In the face of gender equality incidents and workplace bullying, there's absolutely no need to focus on the big picture. That expression, focus on the big picture, or Da Zhu Wei Zhong, was a reference to a hit political series called Wave Makers, which debuted in late April on Taiwanese Netflix. In the first episode, a young political staffer is touched inappropriately by her colleague. She talks to her supervisor, but since she has no proof, she initially decides to drop the case. The supervisor remembers her own experience with harassment and how she dropped it to focus on the big picture. In a scene that's become iconic, they talk on a late-night phone call. Many things can't be forgotten, the supervisor says. If you do that, you'll slowly die. Slowly, they repeat after each other. Let's not forget this. That last expression, "let's not forget this," became the first line of the Facebook post that launched this whole movement in real life. The phrase has popped up across Taiwanese social media as people discuss the allegations and share their own personal stories of harassment and abuse. Chen Meihua teaches sociology at National Sun Yat-sen University.
I think it's the biggest anti-sexual harassment movement in Taiwan so far.
Chen would know. She studies gender rights and used to lead a prominent gender equality NGO. She says when the Me Too movement spread globally a few years ago, it didn't have much of an impact in Taiwan.
Taiwan already have a very strong legislation about anti-sexual harassment.
She says people just aren't following them. And Taiwanese women actually participate in politics at relatively high rates. Just over 40% of Taiwan's legislators are women, and women actually make up the majority of mayors and county magistrates. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, is also a woman. But underneath the surface, politics is hardly an equal playing field, says Lin Liangjun. She's a city councillor in Taipei. Even though Taiwan has more female politicians in higher places, she says, overall women in the workplace still face a higher level of scrutiny compared to men. Lin said sexual harassment in politics is unfortunately quite common. When in public, I've also sometimes been sexually harassed, but couldn't directly point it out, she says. Most of the time when this happened, all I could do was smile and leave the situation. This is why, when accusers came forward in the past week, Lean, along with other women in politics, publicly announced their support for the survivors and committed to providing legal assistance to anyone who needs it. Wen Ti Sung is a political scientist at Australian National University. He says there's only one solution for Taiwan's ruling party.
To get out of this political quagmire, the only way out is through. They need to do better.
The scandal's already having an impact on Taiwan's upcoming general election, and a win for the opposition Kuomintang could push Taiwan closer to China, though there have been sexual harassment allegations against members of that party as well. For The World, I'm Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
There's a lot of talk these days about Beijing and Washington re-engaging. Behind the scenes, it's another story. A report today says that China is setting up an electronic eavesdropping facility in Cuba. Separately, there's news that the U.S., Japan, and now Taiwan are exploring how to share real-time data from naval reconnaissance drones. John Pomfret was a Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. He's also the author of The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, a history of U.S.-China relations. Pomfret says the decision to include Taiwan in sharing intelligence was strategic.
I think the U.S. and Japan have come to the conclusion that they need to bring Taiwan into this whole picture, because to have a blank spot, if you will, about activities, PLA activities around Taiwan would be harmful to everybody's security in the region.
PLA, that's the People's Liberation Army in China.
Indeed.
Does this kind of drone data sharing violate any formal agreement that Washington and Beijing currently have?
I don't think so, unless there's some type of secret agreement. But no, I don't think intelligence sharing is part and parcel of the U.S.-China relationship in terms of dealing with Taiwan. Now, of course, the Chinese will say that it violates understandings and agreements. And particularly, they could point to some of the communiques in which the United States committed to lowering on an annual basis its weapon sales to Taiwan. But the Chinese always forget when they make these statements that that was predicated on the Chinese lowering its military pressure on Taiwan, which obviously hasn't happened.
John, there's another thing going on when it comes to the intel undertakings between the U.S. and China, and that's this Wall Street Journal story that Beijing has reached a secret agreement with Cuba to set up a listening base in Cuba. What's your sense of what that would actually entail?
Well, I mean, one could imagine, and this is purely hypothetical, that the Chinese would take over the former Soviet Signal Intelligence Center, LORDES, on Cuba. This is another example or proof that the PLA and the Chinese intelligence agencies do have global ambitions. Now, the PRC, the People's Republic of China, could easily argue that, hey, you know, you're spying on our borders. You have your spy planes fly back and forth, you know, around our submarine base in Hainan Island on a regular basis. And so we're just giving you more of the same. But it is, for me, very clear indication of the global ambitions of China's intelligence agencies and their desire to monitor more closely any military activity in the United States.
John, I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about what you mean by China having more global ambitions around intelligence, because we've seen these balloons up near Canada and this listening station in Cuba. And where do you see the rest of the globe involved?
Well, I mean, the PRC, the People's Republic of China, is very interested in establishing basing potential. They already have a naval base in Djibouti. There's negotiations to place a naval base or some type of naval facility in the United Arab Emirates. The PRC is also seemingly interested in putting one in the Cambodian coast as well. They have definitely global ambitions because as China has become a global economic power, the People's Liberation Army's Navy wants to be able to be a global power as well in order to literally do, you know, sort of normal things like protect Chinese citizens around the world. And other kind of more sort of imperial things like establish its presence around the world as a major force. And so these type of basing pushes are really sort of, in a way, you could say the naval equivalent of the Belt and Road Initiative, which was the PRC's economic push to build infrastructure around the world in order to increase its political influence as well.
The backdrop to all of this is pretty intriguing. As you say, there's been this diplomatic push by Beijing in recent months, and the U.S. seems to want to get relations back on track. So what do these two developments, drone intel sharing and this Wall Street Journal story about a listening base in Cuba, what do they say about the state of U.S.-China relations?
Well, I mean, clearly the competition is very intense, but clearly both sides are committed towards, from the U.S. perspective, trying to increase Taiwan's security. And on the PRC side, in order to up its game in terms of intelligence gathering so that it has more leverage potentially or more information about what's happening in the United States. So the worry is that while there's a desire, particularly on the side of the Biden administration, to have what they would call a bottom on this falling relationship, the worry is that there's no bottom right now and that Xi Jinping is not interested in that bottom, and it's just going to let it continue to deteriorate.
John Pomfret is the former Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post and author of The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, A History of U.S.-China Relations. Thanks very much for being with us, John.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Smack in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, a scientific expedition struck gold. Not literally. The team of scientists drilled into the Earth's mantle and was able to plunge deeper into our planet than ever before. The world's Anna Kussmer caught up with the scientists on the ship to find out more.
Three PhD students were ending their expedition and making their first landfall in 2 months.
So you're catching us on a day where everybody's getting off of the ship.
Crowded around a computer in a small white room on the research boat, they were about to get on a shuttle to the Ponta Delgada Islands off the coast of Portugal.
But they're willing to answer a few questions for you really quickly.
Their ocean drilling vessel is called the Joides Resolution. And the original goal of the cruise was to dig into the Earth's mantle, to pull up some rocks and ask some heady questions.
So the kind of overall big picture is the origin of life.
PhD student Kwan Yu Lin says the hot, intense environment of the Earth's mantle is a perfect place to simulate the extreme conditions where scientists think life formed.
Scientists hypothesize that this could, you know, be a modern analog of the environment that actually nurtured the early forms of life.
The mantle makes up most of the planet and lies beneath the Earth's crust. It's deep down and hard to access. The drilling location for this expedition was carefully chosen. In most of the ocean, there's 4 miles of the Earth's crust between the seafloor and the mantle. In this special spot in the Atlantic, tectonic activities cause the mantle to be much closer to the surface.
Imagine like a big fault, right, that's slowly pulling the deep mantle out onto the seafloor, close to the seafloor.
The research boat has a powerful drill. The plan was to drill for some cores under the seafloor and pull up some samples. But PhD student Kristen Dickerson says on the first day of drilling, things took a turn.
And we're like, what is happening? Why is this drilling so well? And it's not just drilling well for a mantle hole, it's drilling well compared to any hole. And it's just drilling perfectly.
It was like the drill was cutting through butter, delivering tube after tube of dark rock. The original plan was to stop after around 600 feet. They ended up going to 4,000, much deeper than any other previous expedition.
It's just like, why would we stop? So we just changed the whole plan of the expedition and just kept going because we just couldn't believe our eyes that this was actually happening.
What started out as a plan to study conditions relatively close to the surface turned into an unprecedented look at the deep Earth. And it's just beginning. The samples can offer new clues about what makes up the mantle, its chemistry, and how it changes as it gets deeper, as well as those enduring questions about the origins of life. The team will ship the samples back to their labs, where it will fuel years of research. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Friday's almost here. Thanks for listening. From PRX.